Several years ago now, Larry Walters, a 33-year-old man, decided he wanted to see his neighborhood from a new perspective. So he went down to the local Army surplus store one morning and he bought 45 weather balloons. And that afternoon, he strapped himself into a lawn chair to which several of his friends tied the now helium-filled balloons. He took along a large bottle of soda and milk jugs of full of water for ballast, a pellet gun, a portable CB radio, an altimeter, and a camera. Donning a parachute, Larry climbed into his chair from the roof of his girlfriend's home while two friends stood nearby to untether the craft. Well, he took off a little earlier than expected, however, when his mooring line was cut by the roof's sharp edges, and Larry Walters rocketed into the sky. His plan was to fly 300 miles into the Mojave Desert, but the balloons took him up faster than he expected, and Walters quickly found himself drifting 16,000 feet. As Larry and his lawn chair drifted into the approach path to Long Beach Municipal Airport, perplexed pilots from two passing Delta and TWA airliners alerted traffic controllers that they just passed a man in a lawn chair. Well, Walters was feeling kind of cold and dizzy in that thin air 3 miles above the ground, so he began to start shooting his balloons with a pellet gun, hoping to bring himself back down to earth. Eventually, he ended up entangling his tethers in a set of high-voltage power lines about 10 miles from his liftoff site. Fortunately, he was not electrocuted as he dangled above the ground until finally being rescued. Walters became an instant celebrity as he became known as Lawn Chair Larry. But the FAA was not amused. Unable to revoke Walter's pilot license because he didn't have one, an FAA official announced that they would charge Walters, saying, as soon as we figure out which parts of the FAA code he violated, we're going to write him up. It's reported that soon after he was safely grounded, he was asked three questions. Were you scared? He answered, yes. Would you do it again? He said, no. And then he was asked, why did you do it? Because, he said, a man can't just sit around. Walters had dreamed of doing this for 20 years. And in his own words, he said, it was something I had to do. Church, we can't just sit around. There are things we have to do. And the book of Revelation is a compelling book. And the reason, one of the reasons anyway, I chose to go through this study is not so that we can take our current events and see it all, how it all lines up to what we read here. And so we take it to heart and feel for those God must judge. Please ask God to give you a heart that is tenderly moved, that we feel for those who have rejected Christ. Today is Palm Sunday, in which we remember Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem, where he was greatly misunderstood. But as Jesus approached Jerusalem and he saw the city of Jerusalem, you might recall what happened. He wept over it. He wept over it, for they did not understand his purpose in coming was to save them from their sins. And that's why Jesus came the first time, but when he comes again, it will be to judge. And we see that today in our passage in Revelation chapter 19, here comes the King. And so turn with me in your Bibles and follow along with me in Revelation chapter 19. Revelation chapter 19. Now my hope is what it's been really throughout our time in Revelation is that we take these things to heart and we're compelled to act. That when it comes to reading about the return of Christ and that he will judge the world, that we can't just sit there. We must do something. Well, what is that something for you? Well, look at me, Revelation 19. We focused on the first 10 verses last Sunday, and so we're going to pick it up in verse 11 for this morning. And the first principle is the bridegroom is the warrior. The bridegroom is the warrior. Follow along, chapter 19, verse 11. John says, I saw, or more accurately, and I saw. There's a new event introduced by this phrase, and I saw. But by the way, that phrase, and I saw, is used 8 times in these final chapters in Revelation. The first one's mentioned here. We'll see 2 more just in our passage this morning. And then we're going to see 7 more times with the final event introduced by that phrase, and I saw, in chapter 21, verse 1, the last and I saw a new heaven and a new earth. That's where this is all going. Well, here in 19:11, we're introduced to the first event, and it says, and I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse, whose rider is called Faithful and True. With justice he judges and he makes war. Now let me just stop there for a minute. John sees the suffering servant who came into Jerusalem riding on a donkey is now coming out of heaven riding on a war horse. Now I need to put this scene in context. How does what John sees here fit into what we've been looking at in the 3 sets of judgments? Well, the 7 seal judgments, you might remember, began all the way back in Revelation chapter 6. We were then given additional information of those judgments with our second tour through the tribulation period with the 7 trumpet judgments. And it wasn't until chapter 16 that we were taken on the 3rd of 3 tours, 3 cycles through the tribulation period with the 7 bowl judgments. And the 7th bowl ended with a mention of Armageddon in chapter 16, verse 16. And then we had 17, 18, the allegory of Babylon. But what we see here in this section of chapter 19 picks up with the 7th bowl and what we saw back in chapter 16. So I want to read a couple of verses from chapter 16. You can follow along, keep your finger in this place here in 19. But in chapter 16, verse 16, it says, then they gathered the kings together to the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon or Valley of Megiddo. Verse 17 of chapter 16, the 7th angel poured out his bowl into the air, and out of the temple came a loud voice from the throne saying, it is done. What is done? God's wrath is done. God's wrath is complete. God's wrath is satisfied. His wrath being poured out is over. It is done. Now that was back in chapter 16. The wrath was finished. Yet we still have chapters 17, 18, and 19. Well, remember, think cycles. These chapters are all part of the 7th bowl. And what John sees now in chapter 19 is additional information to the final battle. Last week, we got a glimpse of what awaits us, the wedding feast, remember? And we're coming to the best part of the book. We are coming to the end. There's light at the end of the tunnel here. We're getting there. We're coming to the best part of the book, Christ's return, the 1,000 years of peace and justice on earth with Christ as king and his followers reigning with him. And that 1,000-year reign will come to a climax in an eternal place of undiminished perfection and glorious prosperity, the new heaven and the new earth. And on that day, church, everything wrong with this world will get sorted out. There will be no more loose ends. That's what these verses are about. The groom, Jesus Christ, who left his bride, the church, will return to bring them home to the bridal chamber that he has prepared for us. He will come back. Now, I'm reminded of the story of John McFadden. He tells of a time that he and his wife decided to let their three-year-old son record the message for their home answering machine. Now, you probably, my generation, we did that kind of thing. It was kind of cute. Right? Well, the rehearsals went kind of fine. Mom and Daddy can't come to the phone right now. If you leave your name, phone number, and a brief message, they'll get back to you as soon as possible. Well, the time came, and he says, I pressed the record button, and our son said sweetly, Mommy and Daddy can't come to the phone right now. If you leave your name, phone number, and a brief message, they'll get back to you as soon as Jesus comes. Well, he's got some of that right. Hopefully you return your messages before then. He will come back. He will come back. But you know what? Not like how many think. Not meek, but as a warrior. From the start of Revelation, we have been anticipating the arrival of the King who promised to come for his people. Here it is. Finally, John sees someone burst out of heaven on a white horse. Here comes the King. Now, we're not told specifically that the rider is Jesus, but the picture that is painted here makes it clear that this person is Jesus. He's called Faithful and True. And we've seen that title before, back in Revelation chapter 1, verse 5, and back to chapter 3, verse 14. Faithful, true, there are references to Jesus clearly. So he's the one who's faithful and true. He's the genuine Messiah. This warrior here is the real deal. But why does he come? He comes to judge, it says, and make war. Now, many people don't want a Jesus who is a warrior. But it's part of who Jesus is. I mean, we've been down this road before. We can't just take the parts of Jesus we like while dismissing other parts. The bridegroom is the warrior. He comes to judge. On the first day, teaching his class of 250 college freshmen, R.C. Sproul carefully explained the assignment of his three term papers, that each paper was due in the last day of September, the second one October, third one end of November. And Sproul clearly stated there would be no extensions except for medical reasons. Well, at the end of September, when the first paper was due, some 225 students dutifully turned in their papers, while 25 remorseful students quaked in fear. We're so sorry, they said. We didn't make the proper adjustment from high school to college, but we promised to do better next time. Well, Sproul bowed to their pleas for mercy. He gave them an extension, but he warned them not to be late next month. The end of October rolled around, and about 200 students turned in their second papers, while 50 students showed up empty-handed. Oh, please, they begged. It was homecoming weekend, and we ran out of time. Sproul relented once more, but he warned them, this is it. No extensions next time. You will get an F. Well, the end of November came, and only 100 students, it's diminishing here, only 100 students turned in their third papers. And the rest told Sproul, we'll get it in soon. Sorry, Sproul said, it's too late now, you get an F. The students howled in protest. That's not fair. Okay, Sproul replied, you want fair? You want justice, do you? Here's what's just. You'll get an F for all three papers that were late. That was the rule, right? And Sproul later reflected. He said, the students had quickly taken my mercy for granted. They assumed it, and when justice suddenly fell, they were unprepared for it. It came as a shock, and they were outraged. Listen, Jesus doesn't forgive forever. There's a day that his grace ends. justice will be served. And the war he initiates is the act of judgment on the world's system. The bridegroom is the warrior. Now, every bride wants to feel secure in the love and protection of her husband. A common question my wife asks, either before we get to bed or after we lie down in bed, is she'll ask, "Did you lock the door?" And we live in a safe part of town, but she isn't satisfied with, "I think so." No, that kind of answer just means I need to get up out of bed, go all the way downstairs, and lock the door. And frankly, there have been times my quick answer was yes, so I didn't have to move. Then I felt convicted and got out of bed and walked down to check to see if it was locked. You see, the bridegroom is a warrior. He will protect his bride. The church can rest secure knowing that the groom has us covered. He will spare no expense. He will make war with all that has harmed us, and he will put an end to all unjust suffering. And I can only imagine that the tremendous encouragement that this must have been to the churches John was writing to in the first century. Because John, along with the church in that day, they suffered severe persecution for their faith. Some of the people he knew by name, he had faces to them, they died under the reign of the Emperor Domitian, who oppressed the saints and persecuted them for their refusal to bow the knee to his gods and publicly declare, "Caesar is Lord." Now remember, where's John writing from? He's writing from the island of Patmos. He's not there on vacation. He's not there basking in the sun and doing some snorkeling through the day. No. He was on the island exiled as a common criminal. And the charge was that he was a follower of Jesus Christ and he did not believe in the gods of Rome. So these words here that we're reading in this day of a coming warrior had to be of tremendous encouragement to the churches, to John, to remain faithful, to not give up, to keep on keeping on, for in the end, Christ wins. Church, keep on keeping on. Don't quit. Stay in the game. Fight to the end. The bridegroom is the warrior. He will make all wrongs right. The suffering will end. The evil will be decisively dealt with once and for all. For he is described in verse 12. His eyes are like blazing fire. And on his head, it says, verse 12, are many crowns. Now, there's an interesting word choice for John here because there are a couple of words that he could use for crowns that we see in the book of Revelation. One word for crowns is Stephanos, which is a crown given to those who are victors in ancient games. And so the winner of the game would wear a crown on his head, Stephanos. And it said of believers that in the end, we will be given a crown, a victor's crown. Revelation in the letters to the churches, Jesus said, "Be faithful even to the point of death, and I'll give you the crown of life," Stephanos. To the believers in the church in Philadelphia, Jesus said, "I'm coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take your crown, victor's crown." Well, this crown on Jesus' head, it's a different word. It isn't Stephanos, meaning a victor's crown, but the word is diadem. We sang it earlier. It's the crown of power and authority. It is the one who has absolute control. And it's said that Jesus has many crowns, many diadems on his head. Now, earlier, on two occasions, diadems or crowns were mentioned. There were diadems on the head of the dragon, symbol of Satan, in chapter 12, verse 3. And then we saw diadems or crowns on the head of the beast, chapter 13, verse 1. And it was said that Satan had seven diadems on his head, and the beast had 10 diadems or crowns on his head. But here of Jesus is not seven, it's not 10, but many diadems crowning his head, for he is the true king. True king. He has many diadems. And then it says in the middle of verse 12, he has a name. Now get this, he has a name that no one knows but himself. No one knows but himself. You know what that means, right? If it says here, he has a name written on him that no one knows, you know what that means? It means that people come up with all kinds of ideas as to what that name means. I could give you a laundry list. Why do we do this? Why do we speculate? It tells us we don't know. Have you noticed that something that is hidden from us, that more that's hidden from us, there's a greater need to know? If God wanted us to know, he would have told us. Let's leave this one alone. Verse 13, it speaks of Christ wearing a robe that has blood on it. Now, whenever we see blood on someone's clothing, our question is, whose blood is it? Is it yours or is it someone else's? If it's someone else's, you have a little explaining to do. But the picture here of blood is on Jesus' garments. There's blood on Jesus' garments. Well, whose blood is it? Now, many see this as a reference to Jesus shedding his blood on the cross, and that's why his robe has blood on it. That's possible. I just don't think so in this context. Because the blood isn't Jesus' blood. It is the blood of his enemies. Further down in this passage, the end of verse 15, it speaks of this warrior treading the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God Almighty. Hang on to that. We can reach back to Isaiah the prophet in chapter 63, verse 3. God says there, same picture, I have trodden the winepress alone. From the nations no one was with me. I trampled them in my anger and trod them down in my wrath. Now get this. Their blood splattered on my garments and I stained all my clothing. Now remember a few weeks back, we were looking at Revelation chapter 14, and that's where you say, yes, I definitely remember that, Pastor. And there was the imagery of the great winepress of God's wrath. Okay, starting to come back. Well, the winepress, we talked about it then, had two containers, right? They had this big container at the top where they would throw all the grapes. And then people would stomp on the grapes so that the juice would pass through this little funnel into the lower container. Now, what do you suppose would happen as the people would trample on the grapes? No doubt some of that grape juice would splatter onto their garments, right? Well, as Jesus is pictured coming to earth to stomp on it, crushing his enemies like grapes in a wine press, their blood would splatter onto his garments. What is interesting here is that he has blood on his garments before we see the actual battle. It kind of seems out of order. Blood on his garment, verse 13. The battle doesn't come, as we're going to see a little bit later in the passage, not until we get to verse 19. Well, it's out of order from our perspective as we read this, but what John sees is viewed as already having been done. What John sees, I believe, is the triumphal procession after the victory. And the order is mixed up because it's a vision of the Christ who has already defeated his enemies, that he is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, as we're going to see here in a moment, that the bridegroom is the warrior. He leads in triumphal procession. Well, second principle is our warrior does all the fighting. Our warrior does all the fighting. Verse 14 tells us that our warrior does not return alone. There are those who are following him. Notice verse 14. It says, the armies of heaven were following him, riding on white horses and dressed in fine linen, white and clean. Now again, this is a picture of the victorious king after the battle is won. Why do I say that? Because these soldiers, this army here, they're not dressed in armor. There are no weapons. They're wearing clothing of celebration, not of battle. Now, who are the soldiers? Who are the armies of heaven here? Well, some take this army to be angels. I don't think so. Earlier, John spoke of this in chapter 17, verse 14, as those who are with Christ, they are called and chosen and faithful. Well, who are the called and chosen and faithful? Believers. Same as the bride spoken of back in verse 7. You see, the army and the bride are the same group. Now, when I spoke last week, I thought of this later in the week, but when I spoke last week of the bride and that we are the bride of Christ, all the women in the room get the imagery of the bride, right? I mean, to be called the bride resonates. The picture of the bride works for you. For guys, it's more of a stretch. They were called the bride, right? It's harder for us to kind of get our minds around the bride imagery. But the bridegroom as a warrior, and we his army, okay, I can get that, right? We got that one. Yes! Well, the bride is the same group as the army, and the bridegroom is the same person as the warrior. And the armies following him are all believers who have been raptured and given resurrected bodies. It would include, I believe, the guests to the wedding feast who are the ones who came to faith during the tribulation. But what I want us to see again in Revelation is that Revelation is very clear that there are two groups of people. There are those who follow Christ, and there are those who reject Christ and follow the beast. No one will be able to sit on the fence. You see, you either profess you're for Christ or that you are against Christ. It can't be, well, I'm just going to stay right here for now. I'll decide later. No, you've decided. Right now, you've rejected Christ. That's your decision. It's only one or the other. There aren't three groups, two groups. So I ask the question, is he your Savior? Don't put it off. Don't put it off. It was a holiday weekend when a minister pulled into a gas station and there were many, many cars ahead of him. It was a holiday weekend and everybody's lined up to get gas. Well, finally, a pump opened up and the minister pulled up to the pump. And as he began to fill his car with gas, there was another customer filling up his car with gas, and he said to the minister, you know, it seems as if everyone waits until the last minute to get ready for a long trip. The minister laughed and said, yeah, I know. It's the same in my business. Right? Put it off. I don't need to decide right now. Those who rejected Christ's offer of grace will face him as judge. He will strike down the nations. He will rule them with an iron scepter. And this picture in Revelation 19 is not of Christ coming as Savior, but as conqueror. Now, the scene here is of a major battle. But have you noticed? We don't really see any fighting. All we see is Christ coming with a sharp sickle and striking down the nations. And I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But there's no fighting. It's over just like that. The beast and the armies are gone. With a sword in his mouth, Jesus ends the history of this world. He rules. Who's in charge anyway? It wasn't the Emperor Domitian in John's day. It isn't any ruler who might see themselves as invincible in our day. Because all those in authority, kings and leaders and government workers and whoever is in the place of authority, will ultimately bow to the real King of Kings and Lord of Lords. All leaders will have to deal with Christ someday. And John boldly writes here what he saw written on the rider's thigh. It says, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now, that was incredibly risky for John to write those words. Because he is in exile, we just talked about it, on the island of Patmos because he refused to call Caesar Lord and King. And John unashamedly declares that there is one true king of all human kings. There's one Lord of all those who call themselves Lord. He is Jesus Christ. He's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And as soon as he did that, he had his neck out there. Because he's not declaring Caesar as Lord. He's declaring Jesus as Lord and Jesus as King. Is he your Lord? Do you dare to profess that he is King of Kings and Lord of Lords? Because when the kingship of Jesus appears again, it will be too late to switch sides. Third principle, God knows the outcome before it all begins. God knows the outcome before it begins. Now, isn't that a good reminder? Do you need to hear that today? That we don't know the outcome often. We can't see how this is any outcome or good outcome in sight. Listen, God already has it won. He can see it. And as we just saw, verses 17 and 18, I'm going to read here in a moment, also seem out of order. For the dead bodies are in view before we hear of the battle. Because God knows the outcome before it begins. I'm going to take this whole picture. Verse 17 is introduced with a second of eight "and I saw" statements. Verse 17, "and I saw an angel standing in the sun who cried in a loud voice to all the birds flying in midair, come gather together for the great supper of God, so that you may eat the flesh of kings and generals and mighty men, of horses and their riders, and the flesh of all people, free and slave, small and great." And then the end of verse 21 informs us that all the birds gorged themselves on their flesh. Okay, this is kind of gruesome. There's really no way to soften or downplay this vision. It's graphic and it's disgusting. It's a picture of carcasses being left for the birds to feed on and that the birds stuff themselves on all the dead bodies. And that day, it was considered shameful for a dead body to be left to rot for vultures to eat. Unburied bodies left as food for birds was the ultimate disgrace and indignity. And that was particularly true for kings and military leaders. And so in 19, we now see a second great supper mentioned in this chapter. Last week, we saw the wedding supper, the wedding feast. In contrast to that joyous feast is this dreadful supper. You want to be part of the first supper. You don't want to participate in this meal because in this meal, in this dinner, you are the meal. Verse 19, "And I saw," the third time this is used, "and I saw the beasts and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against the rider on the horse and his army." Now, just remember, God's orchestrating all of this. We saw that back in chapter 16, we introduced this battle of Armageddon, which is likely the same picture here. God initiated this. Early in this chapter, we saw what? With justice, he judges and he makes war. This is all God's doing. God is going somewhere with all of this. He returns as judge. Grace is ended. It is judgment time. And then verse 20 says, "the beast was captured." And the language suggests that this happens in a very short period of time. Again, there's not a lot of fighting here. The capturing happens in an instant. It's the same with the false prophet who's deceived the unbelieving world, because in verse 20 it tells us that both the beast and the false prophet were thrown alive in the lake of fire. And you say, well, what about the dragon? What happens to him? Well, at this point, for reasons we cannot understand, the dragon Satan is still alive and well, and we'll have to wait until we look at chapter 20 to see Satan's doom. So we saw the woman, the prostitute, was called Babylon, destroyed. We saw all false religion is gone. All worldliness is gone. Now two members of the unholy Trinity are no more. The beast and the false prophet are taken out and destroyed. They are the first to be thrown into the lake of fire, for their blasphemy against God was so extreme. Now, I believe that the sickle, the sword in Jesus' mouth, is a picture of the one who can wipe away all his enemies with one swoop. It's all over by a single word from the lips of Jesus. As Martin Luther wrote in the classic hymn, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, he said, "The Prince of Darkness grim, we tremble not for him. His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. One little word shall fell him." One little word, really, is all it takes. And if it really is one word, I think that word will be enough. Enough. Enough suffering, enough evil, enough of Satan's influence, enough of heartache, enough of pain, enough abuse, enough of drug overdoses, enough of mistreatment, enough of injustice, enough. There will be a day when Jesus says, enough, we're done. For the one who spoke the world into existence, the one who spoke to the winds and the waves, and they fell still in an instant, with one word or one single act, it will be all over. Now, did they really think that they could stand up to God and win? Is there any use in fighting God? Before the all-powerful God, the almighty warrior, the abilities and competencies we take pride in are no match. There is no contest. There never is. Here's the truth of it all right here. The bottom line for us today from Revelation 19, 11 through 21. Here's the bottom line. We are all faced with a choice. Surrender or stand up to God. We are all faced with a choice. Surrender or stand up to God. This choice confronts us in terms of our destiny, and it confronts us every single day. Surrender, stand up to God. I can either surrender to God and submit to His will, or I can stand up to God and challenge Him and say, "I don't agree with your views, God. I don't agree with your views about divorce. I don't agree with your views about marriage. I don't agree with your views about homosexuality. I don't agree with your views about sex outside of marriage. I don't agree with your views, God, on how I should treat my enemies. I don't agree with you. I don't agree with your view, God, on pro-life. I don't agree with you, God, on slandering others. I don't agree with you, God, about obeying my parents and submitting to those in authority. I don't agree with your view. I don't agree with your view, God, on taking care of the poor. I agree with your view, God, on laying down my rights for my wife. I don't agree with you, God, about spiritually providing for my kids and what you say about me being a good steward of my time, money, and talents. I don't agree with you. I don't agree with your views, God." And we stand up to God. We fight God. I do it, you do it. But how dumb is that? We just read through a section of Scripture that shows the absurdity to try and stand up to God. But I have to ask you, you fighting God right now? Is there some area in your life that you're just fighting God? You say, I don't agree with your view, God, on this. Are you resisting surrender to Him in some area? Because every single day, we are faced with a choice. Surrender to God or stand up to Him. And the message to the church is to surrender is always the better choice. Even when life is hard, church, keep on keeping on. Don't give up, EBC. Persevere. Keep going to the end. Surrender to Him. It is worth it. It is worth it. In the book Good to Great, Jim Collins writes about Admiral Jim Stockdale, who was captured by the enemy during the Vietnam War. He was the highest-ranking United States military officer and the prisoner of war camp. He was tortured over 20 times during his eight-year imprisonment from 1965 to 1973. Stockdale lived out the war without any prisoner's rights, no set release date, and no certainty as to whether he would even ever survive to see his family again. He shouldered the burden of command, doing everything he could to create conditions that would increase the number of prisoners who would survive unbroken while fighting an internal war against his captors and their attempts to use the prisoners for propaganda. He says at one point that he beat himself with a stool and cut himself with a razor, deliberately disfiguring himself so he could not be put on videotape as an example of a well-treated prisoner. He exchanged secret intelligence information with his wife through letters, knowing that discovery would mean more torture and perhaps even death. Well, Jim Collins had the chance to meet Stockdale later on, who now walks with a limp because his stiff leg never fully recovered from the repeated torture. And Collins asked Stockdale how he could deal with the uncertainty of his fate and the brutality of his captors when he did not know how it would all end. And Stockdale answered, and he said, I never lost faith in the end of the story. I never lost faith in the end of the story. Life can be hard, I know. Struggles are real. There's heartache in your life, sure. Face the pain, don't deny it. But never lose sight of the end of the story. And the best place to be is living in surrender to Him. Because you know He wins. And you know it will be worth it all. Never lose faith in the end of the story.